Welcome to the Title League Podcast. I'm your host, Kurt.
And I'm Trish.
And today we're joined by NBA rising star, Minnesota Timberwolves guard, Josh Okogie.
It's going to be awesome to hear about Josh's journey into the NBA and what he's been doing in the past few months since the hiatus. But when I was doing research for today's show, I found out that he is Nigerian. And I did not know that. I did not know that about Josh. He was born in Nigeria and his family immigrated here when he was 3 years old. And he, like me and you, wears two nationalities very proudly. He's Nigerian and American. I'm Lebanese and Canadian. You, like him, are an immigrant. I'm the daughter of immigrants. But it's a really an interesting path that you walk when you have two countries that you're so fiercely proud of.
Exactly. I am an immigrant, and my kids, if I have kids one day, will be, first generation. But born in Zimbabwe, raised in Africa, immigrated to Canada as a 13-year-old. And I'm sure we'll find out through Josh. But, you know, when I arrived to this country, I didn't play any of the sports that we played in North America. So it was definitely very different and a huge adjustment. But I'm very happy to call Canada and Zimbabwe my home.
Yeah, you know, and you were older. You were older when you came. And so I always feel like it's a little bit surprising. Like somebody like Josh has older siblings, came here at three. America is what he knows the most. You know, being from the United States, being American is what he knows, what is most familiar to him. Yet he still wants to play for the Nigerian national team and is proud of his Nigerian roots. I'm Canadian born, so not Canadian raised. But from the time I was born, my parents really instilled a great pride in being Lebanese and having those two nationalities really identify with who I am. And I always wonder if maybe when you're a little bit older, like yourself, when you're coming in here, if it's harder to, not adapt, but really consider yourself Canadian.
Yeah, it's taken, now 18 years in this country. It still does feel weird to say I'm Canadian, even though I've spent, my entire life's duration, more than half my life now has been in Canada. But it comes down to back to your parents. Like you said, your parents instilled that culture into you, and my parents have always just reminded both my brother and I to remember where we came from. We're blessed to have the opportunity to be in a country that does provide more opportunity. So yeah, I can say now, yes, I'm Canadian.
Yeah, and that thankful piece is so important. We were always taught to be thankful that we were Canadian, thankful that we were, and not just being Canadian, being an American. This is an immigrant story. This is the immigrant path.
Yeah, it's coming from an underdeveloped country to a developed country.
Coming from.
I don't take it for granted. When I go home, I try to go home every single year. You take things for granted sometimes here. You know, I flip on a light switch, the power's on. Yeah. Turn on a tap, there's clean water.
You can flush the toilet.
Wi-Fi.
Just period. You're allowed to flush the toilet.
You know, it's very different. And although we're in 2020, there's a lot of the world that still lives a century behind.
Yeah. And you know, when you think of that immigrant story and you think of the opportunity and some of the really dangerous situations that families fled from, so war and political injustice and famine. But you know, you come here, you come to a new world, and here we are. And we'll talk to Josh about this because he's been a very active voice in the Black Lives Matter movement that has picked up in the last few months. But you know, our parents came here to give us a better life, and so that we wouldn't have to deal with injustices, we wouldn't have to deal with the unfair treatment based on the color of our skin or our religion or whatever the case may be. And so when you come to America and you see that there are still those who don't have that freedom,
it's very sad.
It is. And actually, Josh is ready to join us right now, so hopefully we'll get into this a little bit more with him.
Welcome to the show, Josh. Thanks for joining us. You know, we got lots to talk about today. We appreciate you making the time. Obviously, want to thank a special shout out to Lisa Washington and Calvin for making this happen.
Thanks for having me.
And you know, we'll get into it in a little bit just to give you some context. I was born and raised in Zimbabwe. I immigrated to Canada as a 13-year-old boy. So, you know, you moved to the States when you're three, but you're very proud of your heritage and your culture. So we want to get into that a little bit today. And, you know, I guess we can start right there. But, you know, you played or went to Egypt with Team USA, right?
Correct.
And
2016, I believe.
With Coach Cal, right?
Yep. 2017, sorry.
And then, you know, what ultimately led you to say, you know what, I want to represent my country. I want to play for Nigeria.
You know, it's crazy. Growing up, man, I remember the talk I had with one of my uncles. So when I first got to Georgia when I was like maybe 3 years old, obviously I didn't know anybody outside of my, you know, immediate family. So obviously my mom, my dad, my siblings, we all came here together. But then like my uncles, my aunts, grandparents, they still stayed in back there in Nigeria. So I didn't really, you know, I would talk to them on the phone, but couldn't really match a voice to a face. So 2011 was my first time going to Nigeria, like, you know, being obviously old enough to recognize people. So that's when I kind of met a lot of my extended family members. So when I met my uncle one day, he used to always tell me how, you know, it would be a great pride if one day I could play with the Nigerian national team and represent the whole country and be able to play basketball. Because at that point, I was playing basketball. I was okay. But I never, you know, really dreamed. I mean, I'd always dreamed of going to the NBA, but I never really thought it was a, you know, possibility per se. So it's always been in the back of my head. When I was in college, I got the opportunity to play with USA basketball. So I did that. But then, you know, they reached out to me when I got in the NBA, like, look, man, you know, some of the players even reached out, like, look, man, we're trying to do something special. How would you feel trying to play with the Nigerian national team? And I was always skeptical because I've heard a lot of rumors of how, you know, the Nigerian team just doesn't, you know, put their players first and how they, you know, shortchange a lot of stuff and how it isn't, safe is not the word, but how it isn't, you know, advisable to do that. But, you know, something in me was just like, you know what, I might as well do it, you know, just to get something different, to be able to compete with all the different countries in the world and just to make myself uncomfortable. So, you know, put myself in an uncomfortable situation just to, you know, face adversity and try to play basketball while facing adversity. So that's kind of what ultimately led to my decision playing with the Nigerian team. And I loved every aspect of it, from the teammates to the journeys to Winnipeg to basically competing for, you know, competing on a world stage in a world championship in China. It was beautiful. It was a wonderful experience.
So, you know, you're just saying you've had a lot of fun and it's been an amazing ride so far to represent your country. How many times have you actually got over to Nigeria?
I mean, if you count the time I was born there, then I went in 2011 and I went last year. So that's three times.
Three times. And, you know, what do you have to say? I mean, if for all our listeners, a lot of people never really get the chance to go to Africa. Africa is a huge, huge continent. You know, I try to take people every single year. Whenever I go, you know, I try to make it an annual thing and I take friends with me because I really think everyone should have the chance to visit Africa at least once. So I'm not sure if you feel the same way.
Yeah, I definitely feel the same way, man. Africa is a fun place. It's very, you know, there's a lot of emphasis on family and adventure and having fun. So I feel like you said, everybody should at least visit Africa one time. And I had a lot of fun. The nature is beautiful and pure, and it was just fun, especially with being with my extended family and getting to know them over the years and to be able to have fun and see them and see my grandma. It was great.
I agree. It's truly special place, man. It's incredible. And, you know, now you look at spending the majority of your life in the U.S. and most of your life in the Atlanta area. What's that transition been like playing in Minnesota, man? You know, spending your first 2 years there, there's been a lot that's happened in Minnesota. Most recently with your, you know, first off, actually, with your teammate, Karl Anthony Towns, with his mother passing. Most recently, the entire world that's been put on notice with the passing of George Floyd. You know, what can you speak to? You know, these experiences are life altering, man. You know, going back to Karl Anthony Towns, walk us through some of those times, how you were there to support him as a teammate.
Well, I will say for me personally, this probably been the most eventful year of my life. And I don't mean that in a good way. It's been so many things that have just gone wrong this year. And I think a lot of my teammates, a lot of people around me could say the same, man. What happened to Carl, you know, Carl's mom was, man, it was very sad, to say the least. But one thing about Carl that, you know, that anybody that's around him knows is Carl probably has one of the biggest, brightest hearts. And, you know, you can talk to him today and he will talk to you like, you know, nothing's going on. He would smile. He'll want to make you feel loved. But, you know, it's always good, you know, for us, you know, as a team to be around him and corral around him, make sure he knows that, you know, we're going to do this, get away with this, going to get through this together. And the events with the George Floyd situation, that was, it was mind-boggling. It's just crazy, you know, what this world comes to. And hopefully we can right the wrongs that's going on in this system. Man, that's just, those two things right there can just tell you how this year has been for the majority of people. But personally, I just like to stay optimistic. We're in July, which means, you know, we're in the second half of 2020. So right now I'm just wishing blessings on me and obviously blessings on everybody around me as well. Hopefully we can have, this can be the best year, well, second half year of my life. So
right, we still have a lot of time to turn it around and to make it into something positive. And
for sure, know,
keeping that in mind. Black Lives Matter didn't start with George Floyd. This is a movement that's been going on for quite some time, and something has changed though in 2020. Something has, the momentum and the way that the world is focusing on this movement has changed. And that's one of, from all of this sadness and all of this anger and all of this injustice, that is the one positive that keeps on coming up, that people are taking notice and people are moving. And you've been a really active voice. And I would love for you to tell us a bit about your experiences and your journey as a Black man in America and how you've used your platform that you've been blessed with to push this movement forward just in the last few months.
I think the biggest thing that I've tried to do is to hold everybody accountable, you know, that's around me. Even if you're not around me and I don't know you and I see something that I feel like is wrong, holding everybody accountable. And I think that sense of accountability is what we all need to get through this. I say this all the time, you know, things that we ignore become our standard. You know, when somebody says something that's, you know, racist, or somebody does something that's prejudicing against another race or another person, we can't ignore it. We have to face this head on. We have to be able to hold people accountable, because when people think they can get away with it, you know, it's going to keep happening. George Floyd is just another example of that. Before George Floyd, you know, there was Trayvon Martin, there was Philando Castile, you know, or Eric Garner. It's all these people who were all in the same position as George Floyd. And we've ignored the other cases. We've let the guys who were guilty, we let them go free. So that sets a standard in our lives and in our community. So now when the next person does it, they don't think it's wrong because, you know, the person before them got away with it. So I think that with, like you said, we have a lot of momentum now. The sun always sets before it can rise again. So now that, you know, the sun is set right now, how do we get the sun to rise? And I think we get there by obviously charging, not only charging, but prosecuting the men responsible for George Floyd and prosecuting them justly, you know, giving them the punishment that they deserve. So, you know, we can stop further killings. And this is not right. There's no way on earth that it's okay to put your knee on somebody's neck for eight plus minutes off a mere fact that somebody was allegedly paid something with a fake $20 bill. It doesn't make any sense to me, where you have a guy like Dylann Roof in 2016, who went to a church and murdered about 12 people, and they came in, gave him a bulletproof vest and fed him Burger King. Mm-hmm. Which it just doesn't make any sense to me. But like I said, like you said as well, we have momentum, and what we do with this momentum is is important. We can give the momentum back to the people who are, you know, oppressing us, or we could use this momentum for good and make change. And like I said, make 2020 a different story at the end.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And when we talk about names, I want to make sure that we remember one name, because she still has not been, there's not been justice
Breonna
for her,
Taylor,
and that's
100%.
Breonna Taylor. And we need to keep on saying her name. We need to keep on saying her name and make 100%. Sure that people listen.
I don't understand why people just ignore it. it's crazy. And what makes no sense to me is they made a law, a Breonna Taylor law, but they didn't arrest the people who actually made that law come to fruition, right. Which it just doesn't make any sense. But like I said, we're going to still keep fighting. I'm going to do everything I can to get justice for her, because, you know, a lot of people, they think that, you know, when this time goes on, people forget, but no, I'm not going to forget this one.
That's right. And we're not going to forget. People aren't going to forget. And I'll tell you, one of the best things that I've been hearing, what is different in this conversation, in this dialogue, is people talking about political systems, people talking about voting, people talking about voting in their city elections, people realizing that they have the power to change who the people are that create these laws, that enforce these laws, that we are not powerless, that we have a say. And the fact that that is a conversation that's happening more and more frequently is something very inspiring to me. It makes me really super excited to see what's going to happen and what can happen in the fall and what's going to happen in the months to come.
Yeah, for sure. I think voting is very important. I think voting, you know, obviously the power of voting is very important. It's important that people know, you know, that they have power, and not just, a lot of people tend to say, my vote doesn't count. It's just one vote. One vote isn't going to sway the election left or right. But if you say that, and the people around you say that, and people around them say, before you know it, all those votes, you know, matter.
Right.
Not
they
only
all matter.
Voting, exactly. All votes matter. But not only voting, I think the education piece with voting too matters. Mm-hmm. Knowing, you know, who's, you know, being obviously running for president, knowing, you know, what their pros are, what their cons are, what they want to emphasize when they get in the office, who they like, who they don't like. I think that goes into all of it as well. Not only voting, but obviously empowering the people with knowledge so they know who to vote for. So I think
100%.
Those two things go hand in hand. So like I said, later on this year, I intend on doing some initiatives, trying to get people all the knowledge that they need and all the tools that they need to be able to vote and then vote effectively as well.
That's fantastic. And you know, and we need to encourage people to run. So we've interviewed a lot of NBA players and a lot of people involved in the world of basketball. And we usually ask a question if it's at, you know, close to the end of their careers or what life after basketball is going to look like. My God, I would love it if not because of your fan, not because of your stardom, not because you're known, you have names and you have followings, but because of the skills that you learn and how... I'd be hard pressed to say that anybody who's made it in the NBA doesn't know how to be a team player, doesn't know how to be a leader in their own way, doesn't know how to have humility in order to make sure that the goals are met. Those are all things that politicians should have. Those are qualities that politicians should have. I would love to see more athletes coming out of their careers and moving into the spotlight of politics, because I think that there's a lot of skills that you learn on this journey as an athlete that would translate so well into a political forum, and it could bring some life back into what's traditionally, no offense, but old white guys game.
Agreed. And it's hard though, because, you know, when you're only as good as a team is only as good as each individual player, or the team's only as good as his weakest links. So if you have a guy that's going for office and he's a team player, once he gets into office, if he's around a lot of people who aren't team players, it doesn't make any sense. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So like, it's hard. I think you definitely have to have an influx to kind of mold and start from within a mold and spread that outwards. But that's definitely a great idea.
Yeah, it just takes one, just one. Yeah, and then you keep on, then you keep on moving. You keep on getting somebody else elected and somebody else elected. And there's a lot of levels of government where you need people to help you. And there's lots of boards and agencies. And there's lots of places for people to put their names, ballots for people to put their names on that can create a team that could actually affect change. And I don't know. We'll see. Right. We'll see what happens.
So, Josh, you know, you're young. You're 2 years into what everyone wants is a long NBA career. But with everything going on, have you started to think about what, you know, some of the things that you're going to be doing off the court now, as well as what will come after the court?
Right now, what I am doing off the court, I have a AAU program called Team Nonstop. And I have about 5 different age groups. So right now I'm just doing that, giving back to community. Because I remember when I was younger, you know, it was a lot of programs that were just kind of messy in the sense of, you know, you have to be this way to the get on a team, or you have to know this person to get on this team. So I wanted to create a team where it's, you know, it's fair. You know, it's there's not going to be any biases. And obviously I'm not in it for the money, which kind of gets a little messy too, because a lot of people, they want to.
Seen a lot of horror stories.
Yeah. Exactly. Like a lot of people who own teams want to overcharge.
And then they're taking money from sponsors.
Yeah,
and
there's nothing wrong with overcharging, but if you overcharge, you have to spend the money back to the kids and make sure the kids have the best experience. 100%,
absolutely.
But when you're overcharging, then the kids are staying in the worst accommodations. They're not being taken care of. They're going to the worst tournaments, and you living off the money off the parents of these kids, that's not right. So I wanted to obviously do it in a way that, you know, it's, like I said, I don't need the money. So any money that I get with the program is going back to the kids and make sure the kids have the best experience. Because I was fortunate enough, the team when I grew up playing with, we obviously didn't have the most money, but we had the best experience. We did everything together. Everybody was smooth. We were like a family. And I want to kind of give that kind of family dynamic to the kids that I have today. So that's just what I want to do. And also just to hold these little kids accountable and make sure they have a mentor if they need anybody to talk to, because I understand that there's a lot of things that kids go through today that they need help with and could ultimately shape who they become in the near future. And I had mentors myself when I was growing up. So letting these kids know, you know, if they ever want to reach out to me, they ever need anything, that I'm also a resource that they can go to. So that's what I'm doing right now. I'm trying to, you know, in the future right now, get a foundation to do some things back home in Nigeria. That's for the future. And probably when I'm done, I want to start a mentorship program. Probably when I'm in the brink of being done playing, still want to be in the NBA when I do this, but start a mentorship program where we can mentor, you know, young Black students and be able to, you know, not even in terms of basketball, just in life, you know, teach them. Because, you know, teach them a lot of stuff that they don't teach in the classroom. Because I feel like, you know, the educational system is another system that we have to work on here. You know, kids are learning y equals mx plus b, which is the formula of a line. Why do we got to know a formula line? These kids are coming out of high school, they don't know what taxes are, they don't know how to pay bills, they don't know what a mortgage is, you know, they don't know things that are essential for obviously living on your own and being independent.
They don't know what a budget is.
And don't even know what a budget is, exactly. And if you don't go to these fancy, you know, rich university and colleges, you'll never know that, you know. So I think that, you know, starting young, you know, teaching these kids about credit, because, you know, credit is really how you can drive yourself down in this company and being in debt. So teaching these kids young about credit, you know, giving them a little bit of money and seeing what they do with the money now, because you can obviously with a kid now, I can give my little brother $20 and say, look, you have $20 for the month, it's credit, whatever. I'm giving $20 in cash, and then I give him a credit card with a $20 limit and say, look, you got to manage this $20 bill. You got to manage this $20 credit card. $20 is not going to make or break anybody, but it's the fundamentals and it's the technique of how to spend and how to make sure you have the money before you spend your credit card. And that could be lessons that will last somebody for a lifetime and you only cost $20. So, like, you know, that's the things that I feel like I want to do with the Black community, you know, when I'm on the brink of being done or when I'm done playing, in terms of mentorship.
That's amazing to hear. Giving back, mentorship, you just talked quite a bit about it. When you go back and think about yourself as a young individual coming out of high school, you weren't highly recruited. But you went into your freshman year at Georgia Tech and averaged 16 points a game, and you know, you became a big, big part of that team. So who can you attribute some of that early success to, some of the mentors that you spoke about?
My older brother. I wasn't born here. So when I got here when I was three, obviously my older brothers and my older sister and my parents, they didn't watch basketball. So they didn't really, you know, football is the, as you guys mean, football is the, or soccer. They don't know what football is, but soccer. Is
we call it football.
We know what you're talking about.
I know you guys know. But soccer is like the most dominant sport in where I'm from and where you guys are
in
from
Africa,
too.
In Africa, by far.
Exactly, in Africa. So by far, exactly. So like when I get here, you know, my parents don't have basketball on the TV. I used to, when I was in middle school, high school, I used to turn the TV on, put it on like sports, the NBA. My dad or my mom would always come in the room, be like, no, put on CNN. They would never let me, not that they wouldn't let me watch, but if they wanted to watch TV too, obviously they pay the bills, so they get to watch whatever they want to watch. They will always have me put CNN on the TV. So I didn't really get to watch a lot of, I watched a lot of basketball, but I didn't really
get to. Of course, African parents, my parents, school was first.
School, 100%, 100%. But I didn't really get to, you know,
I think that's all immigrant parents, man.
Man. They used to always tell, my parents used to always tell me, look, basketball, NBA will always be there. You got to get your degree before you go to the NBA. Yeah. But I told them, I used to be like, all right, because, you know, you don't want to argue with your parents. I'd be like, all right. And then my sophomore year, and then we had that discussion. And when they seen the potential, they were okay with it.
Well, I saw a video earlier today of your mom, draft night.
Oh,
I love your mom.
That was the best. That was probably the best moment of my life till this
so
day.
Did you not think you were going to go that high? Like, why weren't you in the green room?
Okay, so in the green room, they only give, because they only have 20 tables. So they only give a table to like 20 of the people, the top 20 people that they think they're going to get drafted. They want somebody to be on the table and the cameras in their face and they haven't been picked yet. So, but there's also the option to go there and be in the audience. But I told, there's so many people that helped me get to that point. I told my agent, I'm like, if I'm not invited to the green room, I'm not going to go. I might as well just, you know, rent out a little.
You're right on the fringe.
Atlanta and have all my family, friends be there and share that moment with me. So that's what we did, and it was like you guys seen the video. It was crazy. It was great.
So before we get there, we did see the video. Oh my God, I almost actually was in tears when I was watching it. I was so happy for you.
She said she cried the Lord's name like 30 times in that video.
It was amazing. Jesus. It was great. Anybody's listening who hasn't seen that video, you need to go online. You need to look it up. Like press pause and go look it up right now.
It was worth it to watch the NBA.
It was so, oh my God. But okay. But if we go before draft night and we get into your high school career. So we have been talking a lot in the last few episodes about rankings and the highly controversial debate of if rankings should be happening or not, or if a rank means anything or what. You were unranked coming out of high school. So I'm curious, in going along with this conversation, this debate of if rankings do are a positive or a negative impact on students, did the fact that you were unranked motivate you to play better? Was it even something that you considered or that you thought about? What was the difference? What happened between high school and college?
Personally, I've always, ever since I was little, they've had rankings forever. Like when I was 11, they ranked 11-year-olds. So like I've always watched myself like be like in a whole state, be 13th, be 12th, and I moved to 9. Like I was always watching it. And watching it, I always used to want to chase number one. And I realized to myself, like, these rankings don't mean that I'm the number 9th player in the state. These rankings don't mean that I'm the 13th ranked player in the state. All these rankings is somebody else's perception of me. Mm-hmm. So I used to always tell myself, it doesn't matter how hard I play. It doesn't matter how good I am. I can't change somebody's perspective of me. So I just kind of always put that in the back of my head. Obviously, use it as flame to fire to play harder, but I've never really paid attention to it. So when I even got to college, like before high school, I didn't even care about who was ranked. As long as I cared about winning, and I cared about going to a college that's gonna help me, you know, fulfill my dreams. That's the only two things that I cared about in college. The rankings really didn't matter. So Because think about college. When you get on college stage, you're in a stage in front of the whole country. You can't hide anymore. Rankings aren't going to save you. So I really didn't. So when I committed to Georgia Tech, I didn't really care about rankings no more, as long as I got to where I wanted to get to. But it's also different because rankings can help you as well. Because a guy like me, say, who is, you know, really not highly ranked, as people like to say, if I had a bad game, people thought that's who I was. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I had to
be a detriment.
Yeah, exactly. I didn't have no margin for error. I had to show up every single day. The people who are highly ranked, they have a lot of margin for error. Because if they had a bad game, they'll be like, oh, he just had a bad game. Like, he'll be back. He's better. And if they have one good game out of six games, they're gonna judge that person off that one good game. A person like me, if I have one good game out of six games, they're gonna judge me off the five games that I had bad versus that one good game. And that's the kind of negative perception of people who are low, not people who are low ranked. That's the kind of the con to rankings is you don't give fair judgment to everybody. And that's kind of the things I had to deal with when I was going through the NBA draft process. I would go into a, cause you know, they had their mock drafts and they had me at going mid, you know, second round to late second round. So when I would go to these workouts and I would go against, strategically, I would like to go against the people who were highly, you know, higher than me in the boards. So when I would go to these workouts and I would, you know, and I would dominate the workout, the tone would be, oh, he just had a good workout, but these guys, they're the guys that we really want. They just didn't have a good enough workout. You know, they didn't have a good workout. I remember one workout I had, it was a bad workout. Like I even told my agent, like, this was the worst workout I ever had. And the feedback I got for the team was like, he's not ready. He needs to go back to school. He should just try again next year. So that's how it is. You know what I'm saying? When you're not highly ranked, they just know, oh man, he's whatever mistake he makes, that's who he is. And when you're highly ranked, it's whatever good you do. It can be minimal good. That's who you are. So that's kind of the imbalance of rankings and how people see rankings. But it forces you, you know, to be sharp and to always, you know, be minimal in your mistakes. So that's what I would say is a plus of being lowly ranked, is, you know, you have that edge. And then highly ranked people, they don't have that edge and they think they can cruise. So it's kind of,
there's a debate, the pros and cons of rankings.
Exactly. So don't get me wrong, there's some highly ranked people who still got that edge, who still got that fire. For example, in my class, Jason Tatum was the number two player in the country when I was growing up. And today he's still, you know, in his class, one of the better players in his draft class. And he's doing great, you know, today and for the Boston Celtics. So that's an example of somebody who was highly ranked, but also still has that edge of got somebody who was lowly ranked. So sometimes it does work out, but you know, more times than not, I think the people who are lowly ranked are, you know, they're not really represented as well as they should be.
So 2 years into this entire experience with the NBA, I'm sure there are times where you are just lying there at night and like, damn, I'm in the league. You know, this year you made a big leap. You were at All-Star Weekend, you know, the USA World Game. Tell us a little bit about the journey so far. And at what point did you realize that, you know what, I am putting people on notice and I do belong in this league?
I think the first time I realized, mind you, I still say to this day, wow, I'm in the NBA. But the first, I had to just let that, just say that out, put that out there. But the first time I feel like I could belong was when I my first preseason game, we played the Golden State Warriors.
Damn.
And I idolized the Golden State Warriors because in college, I love.
Yeah, we hate them up here. Obviously, we all Raptors fans.
I apologize. I forgot.
It's okay. We get it though.
I love the Raptors too. But you know, so to play them in the first game of preseason was crazy. I'm like, wow. I used to watch this team. I used to love this team. Now I got to play against them. And you know, when you watch the NBA as a college student, they're literally where you want to be. So you idolize them. You're like, man, the NBA is just this one big place where it's just superstars after superstars after superstars. And when you get there, you're like, how do I fit in? You know, all I know is college. I don't know nothing about the NBA. So when that first game I played, it didn't even count. It was a preseason game, but I was just playing off.
But you saw the guys warming up. You saw Steph, Clay.
Exactly. Exactly. So when I got on the court and I'm making a couple layups here, making a jump shot here, making free throws, I'm like, this is the same game that I play in college. Obviously, the players are way better. They've spent more time on their craft, and you know, these are the top tier players in the world. But I was like, wow, I could do this. You know, I fit in if I keep working, if I stay at it, if I just keep working hard and trying to perfect my craft. You know, I can do this as well. That's when it kind of just dawned on me, like, I could do this. But I still have a lot to learn. I'm not where I want to be yet, but you know, I feel like I'm heading in the right direction.
So this summer, what are some of the things that you're working on, and what can we look forward to in year three?
This summer, I'm just working on being sharp and being more decisive in my moves. You know, my first year, I was, like I told you, I was just playing off instinct. I didn't really know how to read defenses. I didn't know what to do. If I had a shot, I would just shoot it. If I didn't have a shot, I would just drive and pray to God that something good happens. My second year was kind of that. My second year was tough for me because I was trying to break that mold between being so sporadic and being just out there and reactive and being more proactive and being more in control of my decisions. So I was kind of in the middle of, do I be aggressive or do I wait and try to read? Because you have to be both. You have to be able to be aggressive while being able to read and react. Because I did a lot of reacting my first year, not a lot of reading. Now, my second year, I did a lot of reading, not a lot of reacting. Yeah, so
finding
now
that fine balance. Plus your whole team changed.
It did. So now I'm trying to find, now my year three is, I feel like this is the year I want to start reading and reacting, playing aggressive while also being poised and being able to, you know, be more consistent, knocking my shots down. So that's what I'm looking forward to.
I have a question, Josh. Just, you know, you are an extremely talented musician. Music has been a part of your life from childhood. And I always wonder how that influences or how that helps out your abilities as an athlete. So what are some of the same skills that you have playing piano, playing violin, playing tuba, playing trombone? What else am I missing? I feel like I'm missing an instrument.
Piano, drums, tuba, and trumpet. Those are the four.
Okay. So what skills? Because I mean, I'm a musician. I understand the dedication and the practice and the time and, you know, the repetition. So What of that translates into basketball
sports,
skills and honing your
skills? Sports and music, yeah. Sports and music are the same thing. They're one and the same. I remember, so when I, the reason why I even started playing instruments in the first place, so my dad's a pastor, right? And I used to go to a church. He was one of the senior pastors in the church, but he knew that he would have his own church one day, and he wanted me to play some of the instruments in the church during praise mm-hmm. and worship. So when I first got into middle school, we had band. So he asked me, look, learn an instrument. So, you know, when I get this church, you know, you'd be playing music in the church. So I was like, okay. So I started an orchestra. I wanted to play the violin. And for some reason, I just lost interest in violin really quickly. And like within the first week of orchestra class, I wanted to switch to band.
Yeah.
So sixth grade and band, you can only play the trumpet or the trombone. Those are only two instruments that they let you choose. So I chose the trumpet. I like the sound of the trumpet more. Mm-hmm. But by the time I got to band class, I got there a little later than everybody else. By the time I got there, got my trumpet, everybody already knew the notes, knew how to kind of make the notes on the trumpet. So I was very far behind. So people were playing songs. By that time, I could barely play a note. So it's the same thing as basketball. When you start playing basketball, you will play on a team where some people already know how to dribble between their legs. Some people already know how to make a layup with both hands. Some people know how to shoot from half court, and you're just starting. You don't even know how to catch a basketball. So what you gotta do is, in order to catch up, you gotta put in more work that they're putting in. Because if they're right here and you're right here and y'all put in the same amount of work, it's gonna be like this. They're always gonna stay on top of you. So in order to either get to their level or beat them, you have to put in more work than they are. So that's what I did. You know, I'll be at home practicing my sheet music. I'll be practicing different notes. So it's funny story. When I used to play my notes, because my band director will always make sure everybody knows how to play the notes. So he'll point it. He'll be like, Emily, play D flat. Mm-hmm. Ben, play a C sharp. Josh, play a C. when the band director says, Josh, play a C, everybody just starts looking at me because they know I'm about to mess it up. So, like, even that motivated me. I'm like, all right, I'm not about to be the guy that y'all looking at.
I'm not messing up C.
The band director. Exactly. The band director coming to play a note. Y'all not about to be looking at me every time. So that's when I was like, I gotta get right. So I practiced and practiced and practiced. By that time, before you know it, I'm sitting and nobody's looking at me to mess up any notes. Yeah. Again, I was good. Then my band director was like, okay, you know what? You know, you've mastered the trumpet. This is when everybody starts to, you know, because you can't have a band with this trombone and trumpet. After everybody learns the basses, you switch. Then you start to have woodwinds. You start to have brass. You start to have the clarinets, your oboes, your French horns.
Yeah.
And he asked me, because nobody wanted to play the tuba. So he asked me, Josh, do you want to play a tuba? And he gave me a donut. I took the donut out.
Wow, what a bribe.
I kid you not. He had a Krispy Kreme donut. He was like, Josh, I'll give you this donut.
Wow. That's awesome.
I was like, hey, I'm about to go get a tuba right now. Let me grab this donut. So I grabbed a donut and I became a tuba player. And that, like you said, that's the same thing as basketball. Sometimes, you know, after everybody learns how to do left hand and right hand layups and you're good, your coach might ask you to switch roles.
Yeah.
Like when I started playing basketball, I was a center. And you know, as time went on, I figured out, look, I can't play center no more because it's not conducive to my size. I have to switch to guard. I have to learn new skills. I have to practice in a whole different thing that I'm not even used to anymore. And that's what I had to do with the tuba.
That's right. You're still playing a brass instrument, but it was a different one.
It was a different one, exactly. Mm-hmm. And it was one of the most important instruments in the band because it provides the bass for all the other instruments. And it contrasts with all the other instruments well because all the other instruments are like kind of high in terms of octave, and I'm kind of low.
Yeah, you ground everybody.
Exactly. So that's the same thing in basketball. So after I was a center, I had to kind of learn how to be a guard. Now I have to, you know, learn a new skill set, and I have to spend even more time practicing in order to master this because I have to be at the level of the other guards I'm playing against. So that's how music, I feel like music and basketball is the same thing. Band director is the coach, you know, so, and people come to watch us play instruments in our concert, and the concert is the same thing like a basketball game. So when the lights are on, you have to be able to perform, because if you mess up, everybody can hear you. Basketball, everybody can see you if you mess up. So
it's all an art form, man.
It's the same thing. Basketball to me is an art as well. So
now going into this third year of your career, you said coming out of college, you're watching these guys, your first preseason game against the Dubs. The Raps won the championship last year. What's motivated you now to, you know, regular season, we got to get through it, but I want to compete at the highest level. I want to get to the playoffs. Do you have that itch?
Yeah, I'm not even going to lie to you. I was actually talking to my coach today because the fact that 22 teams went to the Orlando bubble to go compete and, you know, we weren't part of those teams, that's still to today, really grinds my gears. So I'm definitely going to use that as flame because it doesn't feel good being left out. So I'm piped up.
You're ready. It's gonna be an exciting season. You guys have a very exciting young team. I mean, with D'Lo, Kat, yourself, and who knows what the draft's gonna bring. But it's gonna be a very exciting season. Obviously, we don't know what this year is gonna look like as it finishes up. But I'm sure you're super excited to get back to playing.
Yeah, I can't wait. I also told my coach that I'm just craving competition. It's like the longest I've been without competing. Like workouts is cool, like being able to go to the gym and get up 500 shots or shoot free throws, that's cool. But you just want to play that one-on-one, that two-on-two, three-on-three, four-on-four, five-on-five, whatever it is, shooting games, anything, just that competitive fire that's just stored in me. It's been stored in me too long. I'm just trying to let it out. So hopefully all these restrictions and this coronavirus – I mean, goes down soon, so we can get back at it. But this is definitely unprecedented times, which I understand. So I'm not trying to rush anything if it needs time to clear up. But nonetheless, I'm trying to get after it.
I think we all are, man. We're excited to watch basketball again. But as an athlete, I want to get back to playing pickup. You know, I ain't in the league, but I want to play. I want to compete. So I feel like I can attest to you there. You know, just a couple things. Lastly, who was a player that you looked up to when you were coming up?
When I first came to the States, the player that I feel like I liked the most was Carmelo Anthony. I love Carmelo. And then, you know, as time went on, my favorite player was Kevin Durant.
Wow. And now you get to play against both of them.
Exactly. Which is fun. It's fun.
That's wild. And do you have a relationship with Melo?
I don't. Not really. I don't have a relationship with either of them, actually.
And what do you think? I mean, Melo's obviously being, he just put out that Slam magazine. You know, he's been very outspoken on Black Lives Matter, some of the work that he's doing. You know, he's at a point in his career now where he's a leader in the league. He's transitioning out. What do you think about some of the work that he's doing?
I mean, him and even the whole brotherhood with, you know, Chris Paul, Dwayne Wade, LeBron James, they've been great. They've been a great staple in the NBA community in terms of representing the Black community, not only in the NBA, but in the world, repping them, you know, fairly and, you know, speaking out when things aren't right. I think, forget which ESPYs it was, they all came out and gave that piece on, you know, the injustices that was going on in the country, which was great. And for Melo to have that Slam magazine with him and his son on the cover is great. And I understand, you know, he's just trying to make a better world because, you know, obviously, you know, his son is going to have to live in this, grow up in this world. So, you know, as a father, he's just trying to make sure that, you know, when his son grows up, he's growing up in the best, in a world that's going to treat him with, you know, the love and respect that Melo treats him with. So, he's been great with that, and I, you know, I definitely appreciate him for speaking out and being outspoken in these times.
You know, we come, you know, we were talking earlier about the backgrounds that we all come from, and we come from countries where there isn't a lot of where there is a lot of political unrest, and a lot of times our families leave these countries in order to come to America, where it is a brighter future and there are more opportunities and our children are safe and, you know, there isn't political strife. And then you kind of realize that it's a different kind of political strife that happens here. And it's a different kind of danger that our kids face, and that not all of us are treated equally and not all of us have the freedom that our parents sought out. You know, I think that, again, I've said this numerous times on this show and in other conversations, it makes me so proud to see so many people using their platform to push this and to make sure that they are doing everything within their power to really honor what our parents and so many other immigrant parents came here for, which is to give us and then our kids a better generation, a better life.
Yeah, for sure. Like my parents always make sure, like I grew up in a household where I had four siblings and my parents used to, they were like the no mistake parents. Like we can't make any mistakes. We can't go to jail. We can't get F's on our progress reports. Like we have to be so very like perfect. And not even perfect isn't the word.
Just hard working and appreciative exactly, from the sacrifices.
Exactly. Because they brought us here, like you said, for you know, a better kind of living than they had, a better opportunity. So they just wanted us to make the most out of our opportunity. But, you know, in today's times, it's important that, you know, these families that immigrate here, that they have a kind of safe haven or a safe path, at least. You know, nobody's saying that you should make it an easy path. Like, I don't think Black people are saying we need an easy path, but we at least need a safe path. You know, like I shouldn't have to, I should be worrying about passing the test.
That's
I should
right.
be worried about getting good grades on my SAT or ACT so I can get into a good college. I should be worrying about studying or going walk to the library to make sure I got the books in order to ace my exam. I shouldn't be having to worry about the walk to the library.
That's right. That's right.
I shouldn't be having to worry about the drive to my university.
That's right.
That's not what I should be worrying about as a immigrant, you know, trying to make a better life.
And you shouldn't be worried about the people who are there to protect you.
Exactly.
Whose job it is to protect you. Because again, exactly. I don't know Nigerian politics, but I know Lebanese politics. I know that we are taught to not trust police. We are not trust we're taught to not trust politicians, but you come here and you're taught this is where everybody is good and this is where systems are fair. And there are still people every day who don't live that reality. That is not real to them. Those systems are not fair and they're not safe for them.
Yeah. And the crazy thing is, like you said, like in Nigeria, the politics aren't safe either. People know not to trust politicians. People know not to trust police. And I don't think the politicians or the police put on a facade like you should trust us, which right. is the crazy part. But I think that's the problem here. Everybody says, like, you know, you should be able to trust police. When you're in trouble, call 911. Oh, you should be able to, you know, trust your politicians. The politicians are supposed to be fair to its constituents, but that's not the case. And that's what's the problem today. They're telling you, you know, you're supposed to be able to trust these people. But in reality, you can't. And it's not that we're saying you can't. They're telling us that we can't, you know, based on what's been going
on. Their actions are showing that there are certain people in these positions that don't respect the position that they're in and don't respect what the position means, because politicians and police officers are respectful positions. They are positions that we should trust and that we should feel safe in. But we have individuals who don't hold them in respect.
Right. And this sucks, because I know a lot of great policemen here in Minneapolis that have been nothing short of kind to me and to anybody that's around me. So I know for a fact when things like this happen and people are saying, like, you know, F the police or whatever, like, you know what I'm saying? Like, we don't want the police, like all the bad things they're saying. It's crazy, because
the worst message. That's the worst message. That's not true.
It sucks, because I know personally of good police officers that are out there, but it's just, it only takes, and like a lot of people say, it's just a few bad apples, but I disagree with that statement, because there's some occupation that should not have bad apples.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
What if Delta or any other airline comes and says, look, we're a great company, you should fly with us, but just be aware we might have some bad apples.
I ain't flying.
Yeah, right.
You would never fly.
No.
That's the best analogy I've heard.
Yeah. Like, what if you go to a doctor's office, they're like, look, we're most great with what we do, but sometimes most of our surgeons are good, but just keep in the back of your head, we have some bad apples in here, but they are not. Don't mistake the bad apples with the good. We have a lot of good ones. I would never step in a doctor's office. Like, same thing with police officers. You should not have a bad apple.
That's right.
Yeah, you can't have bad apple, because you're here to protect people's lives. And when there's nothing more important on this world than a life. So if you're out here just having bad apples in every police force, then what are we really doing? It doesn't make any sense to me. And I feel like you shouldn't be able to be a college dropout, high school dropout, and become policeman. Policeman, you should be able to have a degree. The training should be more extensive, or as much money as
the mental, the mental health police testing should be more extensive.
Exactly. Like, we shouldn't have police that just have a GED. Like, that's unacceptable.
Do you know how many times do you read that people who, I mean, like, if they're a police officer or if they're in some form of security and it says that they've applied for the military numerous times but like don't pass the mental fitness test. I think all these things should be doing the same mental fitness test. I think that they should be the same caliber of testing. Yeah. Anyway. Okay. We were pretty light, and then we got serious again. So now I'm going to make it light again. I want to say one thing. We usually end the show with three really silly questions that we don't want you to think about too much, but you can give us just the first answers that come to mind. Before I ask the questions, I want it known on the record that I think that you're one of the swaggiest players in the NBA, and League Fits does not give you enough credit. I need to see more pictures of you.
Man.
Wow, that's credit.
When this episode drops, tag League Fits, man. I tell my teammates, obviously Andrew Wiggins, who's
Canadian.
When he used to be on the team, I used to be like, bro, I got this nice outfit I'm wearing today, man. I hope I get on League Fits. And it will be crazy, because I'll go get the picture, make sure the picture got the best edits and everything.
Yeah, there's not enough love.
I'll go out there and just after the game look at my phone and see nothing. And then I'll go on League Fits and see somebody who just wore a sweatsuit.
And you're like, yeah, what the hell?
Yeah, no.
Man, what is it going to take for it?
It is disrespectful.
It's funny that you said that.
Josh, I'm telling you.
Yo, I'll tell you, Josh, we were having this conversation earlier, and I said,
she's like, wow, Josh has the swag. I'm like, yo, Nigerians, fellow Africans, we know how to dress well. Our parents teach us. Sure.
You know what I'm going to do next year? I'm just going to come out with my native dressing. They're going to have to
They're going to have to. Anyway, have to. League Fits, if you're listening, we need more respect. We just win.
For sure.
All right. Our three final questions. So first one, if you were going to write your autobiography today, what would the title be?
Nonstop. Oh. I don't know.
No, yeah, no, I like that. Perfect. That's what it will be. That's good.
Yeah, nonstop.
And if there was going to be a movie made about your life, who would play you?
Who would play me?
Yep.
Denzel Washington.
Oh, yeah. Okay. And if there's one TV show that either past or present that reflects the way that your life is right now, which one would it be?
The Office.
Wow.
I think so. The Office probably.
That's awesome. Man, this is being a lot of fun today, man. I'm so happy you were able to join us.
I appreciate you guys for having me.